You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. classicalspecialneeds.com.
It is one thing to hold our beliefs, in particular for Christians in America today, our deeply held beliefs about marriage privately. It's one thing to think these thoughts and to be able to have this as the framework and the worldview that guides your everyday life. It's quite another thing to defend those beliefs, to be able to articulate it to someone who either doesn't yet understand or doesn't want to understand your beliefs about marriage. When we talk about marriage, we often append that adjective, natural marriage. And there's a reason for that. It's because the assertion, especially from a Christian context, the assertion is that marriage is an institution that is woven in, built in to creation by our Creator. We're going to be talking about defending natural marriage for the second hour of Issues Etc., the first half hour of the program on this Wednesday afternoon, August the 12th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Thanks for tuning us in for the second hour. We are broadcasting from the Finding Our Voice Conference at St. Louis University. Sharif Girgis will join us here for the first half hour, co-author of the book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman in Defense. And then Dr. Alvin Schmidt will be our guest. We'll talk with him about sexual fidelity in a pagan culture, get a little historical perspective on that issue that is still with us today. Sharif Girgis is a regular guest. He's a PhD student at Princeton University and a law student at Yale Law School, co-author of the book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. Sharif, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the ability for the kind of average person to articulate what we mean when we say natural marriage. I think for many of us, I think in my context, I could probably do it because I've had conversations with people like you. But just as a husband, it's just the reality I live in. It's the air I breathe, and I can't imagine anything else being that. Talk about the ability to articulate what we mean by natural marriage.
Well, I think your experience is really widely shared. I was certainly in that position myself. I think a lot of us have been caught sort of blindsided somewhat by this debate because it's questioning fundamentals. It's asking us to explain the bedrock that we would use to explain anything else, the reference point that we use for our lives, the idea that kids need a mom and a dad, that marriage is about family life, not just about emotional fulfillment. That those things are essential, but until recently, we haven't had to defend them, and that's why we need to equip ourselves to do that.
How have we done on this? I mean, we've been debating this now for a decade in the public square in a real active way. How have we done in articulating natural marriage to a public?
I think it's fair to say that we've done pretty poorly. For years, all we could come up with was, well, it's kind of always gone this way. I believe in marriage is a man and woman because of tradition. Maybe in the best case, someone would say, well, just because I'm informed by my faith. They're never able to explain it. In that respect, I really think it's just getting started. And it's in that sense, much like the pro-life debate. I think the pro-life debate blindsided pro-lifers in the early 70s. People weren't ready. They weren't gearing up for decades for a debate about the unborn. And it took a long time. It took 30 or 40 years before we have seen what we've now seen now for a couple of years, which is that the polls are trending in the pro-life direction. My generation, the millennial generation, is more pro-life than our parents, and that trend promises to continue. I think what happened is that people were woken up by the Supreme Court decision, and they did their homework, and they did their part to figure out a language to defend this view.
Speaking of the language or the nomenclature, how do you assess the term traditional marriage?
You know, sometimes it's got to be used. It's the best thing nearby. But I think actually it undersells our view. Mm-hmm. It implies that, A, that it's just the way to do it because we always have done it, and there's a lot more to say in favor of this view. The other thing is it kind of suggests that it belonged to one or another particular tradition. Like maybe this is how we do it in Christianity or in the West. And those things are certainly true. But they're not just in Christianity or in the West, much less in the Anglo-American tradition or anything more specific. It's a really universal thing. It crosses traditions anthropologically, culturally, religiously, historically. And something like that, that's why the term natural marriage, whatever its costs and benefits, at least reinforces this sense of universality.
Okay. You have spoken here, and you've spoken many times about marriage in a, and I'm just kind of grasping at a term here because I can't think of a better one, in a, it urged us to think about it in a holistic way, that it is a union of persons that are not just bodies and not disconnected spirits. What are you talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to look at this is that marital love, romantic love, seeks total union with the beloved. And then the question is, well, what's that going to look like? If you have to have a total union of persons, you have to figure out what a person is. And in our own tradition, and not only that, I think according to reason and faith, you can see that, well, people are heart, mind, and body. So marriage is going to have to encompass all of those. And I think that's a vision that that points towards the male-female model of marriage.
You also use that picture of total union to evaluate and to critique what we could call alternate lifestyles or alternate options that people have set forth for a natural marriage. How would you do that?
Yeah, well, I think on the main alternative view that's going today, that was formally and kind of finally enshrined in our law by the Supreme Court decision on marriage, but that's really was also at stake, I think, in no-fault divorce and other marriage debates. It's not just a gay-straight issue. That was a vision of marriage as mainly a certain kind of emotional bond. It's your soulmate. It's your number one relationship. And that vision can't explain why marriage has to be permanent. If the feeling goes away, why hasn't the marriage gone away? It can't explain why it has to be exclusive if that's not what promotes emotional fulfillment for you. Can't explain why it has to be two people, three men or three women, can have an emotional bond as well. So it really, even though it's attractive on the surface and a lot of people talk in that soulmate language, it's not enough. It doesn't pick out marriage as opposed to other forms of companionship, whereas this more traditional, or what we call the conjugal view of marriage, does. It can explain marriage as a union of heart, mind, and body. That bodily union points to family life. So it's also a relationship oriented to family life. And because of that, it requires permanence and exclusivity and the other norms that give it stability and serve the common good.
We've talked with guests many times about this issue, and often the tactical approach to natural marriage is to talk about marriage having a natural end in childbearing and then, of course, in child rearing. What are your thoughts there?
That's absolutely essential. It's not just a means to kids. So it's not like, well, it's just a sort of tool for boosting SAT scores or something. And then as soon as the kids are off to college, or in the case where there aren't kids, that there's nothing to keep together. On the other hand, it's not just totally disconnected from family life. It's not just like, well, you could raise kids if you want, or you could go mountain climbing if you want, and that could make a marriage. It's that marriage is fulfilled and extended by family life. That's its natural fulfillment. So you have a marriage as soon as you have a total union, heart, mind, and body. You can have that on the wedding night, a year before the first kid comes around. They're totally committed to each other, and they unite in the marital act, which is also the life-giving act. But it's fulfilled in family life. And so even when the spouses personally wouldn't pick these stabilizing norms of permanence and exclusivity and monogamy, they're the ones that are fitting for that kind of bond.
Is that the consequence that is not considered when someone proposes an alternate to natural marriage?
Yeah, I think people think, oh, they just look at the households that are going to get the benefits, or they look at the couple. They don't look at the wider cultural effects. One way to see those cultural effects is to think about what lessons the marriage law is going to teach. If your marriage law says marriage is an emotional union, if it says it's mainly for the personal fulfillment of the partners, if it says that moms and dads are perfectly replaceable, in fact, it's bigotry to think that fathers are essential or that mothers are essential, Well, how are people going to live when they grow up absorbing those ideas? Are they going to be more or less likely to stick with a marriage when the going gets tough, or to try to get married before having kids in the first place, or to stick around for the sake of the kids? These things have consequences.
So you're talking about the law as a teacher, and if the law has essentially been gutted so that the only state's interest, and I have a difficulty seeing how it's a state's interest at all, is the heart wants what the heart wants, what will that teach the next generation and the generation after that?
I think it's just going to teach them a vision that makes it much harder to stabilize marriage. I mean, the reason that every society that's ever survived long enough to leave us a trace of itself has had a marriage regime, has had some kind of social regulation of the sexual relationships of men and women, is that they make kids. And kids don't just come out fully formed. They require years of being shaped by their own mom and dad. That's something that marriage law provides, and that this marriage law will have a harder time doing.
With a minute here before we take our first break, we certainly can craft a philosophical definition of marriage. Do we need a legal one in our society?
I think we do. It's not enough for people to have these views. They have to encourage each other to live by them, and that's what the law does. If this were just a religious issue, if being raised by your own mom and dad were just good for you for Christians, it'd be one thing. But it's not. That's something that's a human good. It's a universal good. And so we need an institution promoting it across the board. Particular religious traditions can do that for their communities. The law can do it for the whole community.
Have we lost that war, or are we just starting to fight that war? About 30 seconds.
I think as with the pro-life movement, again, we're really just starting. You know, people didn't throw in the towel after Roe v. Wade. They said, all right, now this clarifies and focuses our debate. It means we have to be in it for the long haul. We can't just turn this thing around in the next month or the next year. But I think we have to have the same attitude about marriage and family. It's too important an institution just to give up on.
Sharif Girgis will be with us for another 10 minutes on the other side of the break. We're talking about defending natural marriage. It's Wednesday afternoon, August the 12th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Why do the gospel accounts differ? Why did Jesus use parables? Are there demon-possessed people today? The Issues Etc. book of the month for August is the big book of New Testament questions and answers. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Big Book of New Testament Questions and Answers is written by Dr. Michael Eschelbach of Concordia University, Chicago. The Big Book of New Testament Questions and Answers.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Sharif Girgis, co-author of the book, What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense, broadcasting from the Finding Our Voice Conference at St. Louis University. Sharif, we talked before the break about a legal definition, and I know we've talked before about kind of a philosophical definition of these things, but how do you envision that being codified? I know you're pursuing a career in law. What would such a law even look or sound like?
Sure. Well, it would be a law that said that encouraged some of the ideals of marriage just by its admission requirements. So it's a marriage law that says you have to be a man and a woman to get married. You have to have the maturity to make a lifelong commitment, and where the commitment is hard to get out of. So that's going to teach something about permanence in marriage. So we're going to have to roll back no-fault divorce to a significant extent. Right now, it's easier to get out of your plumbing contract than it is to get out of your marriage contract. That's a problem. A lot more hangs on marriage than hangs on a particular plumbing agreement. So that's one thing. It can be a law that, even without imposing criminal penalties on anybody, is still going to encourage things, even in some cases by different kinds of penalties. So, for example, in cases where a divorce does happen, and it's because of a clear and demonstrable fault of one of the parties, adultery or abandonment and so on, then there will be consequences in the distribution of the property, in the privileges and custodies with respect to parenting. So it's a vision of law that's going to support these norms of marriage. It can't do all the work all by itself. We need the culture to reinforce what the law teaches, and we need particular communities for that. The churches, the media, all these institutions have their own place in that broader scheme. But the law at least will not teach the wrong view, and where it can, without too much coercion, it's going to support the right view.
You talked about rolling back no-fault divorce. What would that mean in the short term in a society where it is currently legal for, at the very least, same-sex couples to marry, opposite-sex couples to marry, maybe in the near future, some variation on the themes to marry? What would say, let's return to a fault-based divorce system legally? What would that mean?
Well, it would mean that in order to get out of the marriage contract, to be free to marry another person legally, and to get out of the obligations that are specific to marriage, you would have to demonstrate in divorce court that there was some reason for that. And traditionally, in common law, for example, in our own Anglo-American tradition, some of the bases were, you know, pretty important reasons to be able to separate legally. Abuse, for example, or abandonment, or adultery, the sort of most significant kind of betrayal of the marital commitment by one of the parties. And absent any of those things, and an ability to demonstrate them, you would be expected by law and by culture and by the broader society to stick with the marriage.
So, in essence, we're talking about, at least for the time being, imposing by law a situation that prevailed prior to no-fault divorce in the United States. That is, there was a burden of proof to be met. There was, the state's interest was, the state would say, it's better that you stay together rather than divorce, but divorce will be granted under certain circumstances. Is that what we're talking about here?
That's right, and it's just the flip side of this being a public status in the first place. The reason marriage is a public institution and not a private one like a baptism or a bar mitzvah is that public goods are at stake. Where marriage fails, or where it fails to form in the first place, very often kids suffer. Women tend to suffer more than the men as a result of the breakup of the relationship. The poorest in our community tend to suffer the most because they don't have other cushions financially and socially. And guess what? The rest of society foots the bill and does a worse job at it, because the most efficient way of serving the health and well-being of children and of the spouses themselves is the stability of marriage itself. So where that fails, there are public costs. And the flip side of that is that we're going to have a public institution for it, but there will also be public reinforcement of the commitment.
Well, then let's talk about the political ability and will to do something like this. Do our politicians, and I'm painting with the broadest of brushes, do they understand what they need to understand to even begin this?
No. This is a long battle. But here's the interesting thing. The battle wasn't all hopeless, even in very recent political memory. So just about 12 or 15 years ago, you saw the beginnings of a consensus among social scientists that no-fault divorce had worked real harms. You saw people on the left and on the right start to say, you know, we thought it would be enough to have some loving parent in your life, but turns out two parents or mom and a dad are better. We thought that it's always better for the divorce to happen because the kids don't like conflict. It turns out that except in the very highest cases of conflict, stability mattered more than anything for the sake of the kids. And we found it had real consequences. And as a result of that, you saw the beginnings of a very fragile consensus in the sociologists and the policy advocates and so on for some kind of questioning of no-fault divorce. I think given another 10 years, that could have started to make political inroads because you had left and the right among the policy experts. The thing that cut that conversation off was the beginnings of the same-sex marriage debate when Massachusetts, for example, required it, the Massachusetts state court required it there. So I think that's why these things are connected. You know, the ability to speak out in favor of male-female marriage, kids needing a dad, and so on, is closely connected to our ability to have the political will that you're talking about down the road to begin rolling back these other more harmful effects of the sexual revolution.
What I often hear from politicians, and we could hear it echoed in, say, for instance, the primary debate among the, several hundred Republican candidates there, was when asked questions about marriage, and they often do this on the campaign trail too, with all good intentions, they turn to their faith. Well, my faith informs me that marriage is this. My belief is this. My church says this. To me, every time I hear that, I cringe, not because the statements aren't true, but because it seems to permit a very simple criticism, which is, well, then how could you possibly impose your religious tradition, faith, or private belief on anyone else other than yourself?
Yeah, I think that is a problem. I think there are two things to say. One is that sometimes people just make that argument on the policy issues where they don't like how the religion comes out. So the New York Times will print op-eds by bishops saying we need to be welcoming to immigrants, but then they'll denounce the same bishops for saying we need to welcome the unborn. They just don't like it when the religion favors the wrong view. But the second thing to see is that you're absolutely right. We don't want to reinforce the idea that this is just a religious idea. The principle is, you know, when these politicians are asked, I wish they would say something like, well, I believe in a kid's right to grow up under the same roof as their own mom and dad, as the man and woman whose love gave them life. Do you? Do you disagree with that? Do you think it's better for them to just have any two parents? Should we institutionalize a missing parent? That's what same-sex marriage law does. It guarantees that every household admitted under the new regime of same-sex marriage is not going to have either the mother or the father of those children. Those are the natural and human interests that we need to be pointing to.
Why can't, we've got about 3 minutes here, why can't a man and a man or a woman and a woman, however much they love each other, be a marriage?
Well, because love is not all that makes a marriage. It's crucial, but it's not all there is to it. We have all kinds of loving relationships, of best friends, of teacher and pupil, of father to son or mother to daughter, of brothers and siblings. What makes marital love distinct is that it's a union of heart, mind, and body. Bodily union means coordinating together towards a single bodily end. That only happens between a man and a woman in the marital act. It means a relationship that's by its nature oriented to family life. That only happens where the very act that makes marital love is the kind of act that makes new life. That's the kind of relationship that can give kids a mom and a dad. That's only true between a man and a woman who can give both their kids the connection to both biological parents. So to say that they're not a marriage is not to say that they're less. That's the new view of marriage that just says it's the max, it's the number one bond, period, end of story, soulmate. This is actually a more expansive view. It says you can have deep and fulfilling relationships of all kinds. You can have real companionship and commitment without a sexual or marital connection. But marriage is more specific.
So in other words, this allows society to say we're not only pro-natural marriage, we're pro-friendship, we're pro-siblings, we're pro-every kind of relationship that you want to have, but marriage is unique.
Absolutely, and it's by making marriage more specific that you open up the horizon for single people, for example, and you're going to have single people no matter what your marriage law is, to be able to find deep personal and social fulfillment in a non-marital or non-sexual relationship. It's liberating in that way.
With only about a minute here, are we going to see almost immediately the consequences of redefining marriage in the actual lives of the people who are celebrating the redefinition?
I think so. You've already started to see that. In the Supreme Court case, there was an amicus brief filed by 6 children of same-sex parents to say, we loved our 2 moms or our 2 dads, but we missed the other parent, even in cases where we didn't know them. We lost out on something that we were owed. And that's why we fight the redefinition of marriage, not because we hate anyone. And they were grateful in all those cases to their own 2 moms or 2 dads for what they did. But what they couldn't provide was the love of a mother or of a father, where that was missing. And I think you're going to see more stories like that that tell in heartbreaking terms the real human costs of this privileging of adult desires over the needs of kids.
Sharif Girgis is a PhD student at Princeton University and a law student at Yale Law School. He's co-author of the book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. You'll find a link to it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Sharif, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, a regular guest here on the program, getting an historical perspective on sexual fidelity in a pagan world. It certainly is the past reality for the Christian church living in a pagan context, and it certainly is the present reality as well. Dr. Alvin Schmidt, right after this.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
When the Apostle Paul stated, I have become all things to all men, was he talking about fitting in with the world? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled All Things to All Men. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read Pastor David Wan's story of failing to find Lutheran theology in several Lutheran churches, but finding it in Scripture and the Lutheran Confessions, the free online Issues Etc. journal.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The Gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the Gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
A confessional liturgical Lutheran congregation in southeast Michigan, in Rochester Hills, the Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word, that's LCIW.org. We gather for the divine service every Sunday, 9:30 a.m. at Lutheran High School Northwest. The Lutheran Church of the Incarnate Word. Find us on the internet at LCIW.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Postmodernity is, well, vehemently anti-institutional.
Pastor Chris Roseborough, host of Fighting for the Faith, speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
Institutions are bad in the way of postmodern thinking, and that would include an institutional church. And so people who've bought into postmodernity, they'll talk about the church as a movement. It's a dangerous way to think about the church because a movement doesn't need office holders. A movement needs leaders, leaders that get results.
You can listen to Chris's entire presentation, Making the Case Against Vision-Casting Leaders in the Church, on a new audio DVD of the 2015 Making the Case Conference. We'll send it to you for a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day. For more information, look for the DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.